This is side one, the first part of two tapes. October 3rd, 1979, Seattle, Washington. An interview with Professor Martin Duffy and Christine Miller, research analyst, University of Minnesota, Labor Education Service, concerning the Minneapolis General Drivers' Strikes of 1934.
Here.
We have it to a regular Minnesota Indian summer out here.
Well, it's cool here, but it's pretty. Okay, I'm a little late today.
That's all right.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's all right. I keep getting all these phone calls. They interrupt me.
I know how it is.
Some days I just like to get rid of the phone. But
that's right.
Okay.
We can't do it.
Nope. So, I wanted to let you know that that I spoke with George Monahan of the Minneapolis Star yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very pleased to have quotes from your interview.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that I that he will most likely use have to do with your interview on August 16th when you were describing both Charles and Ray's
Dobbs
ideas about violence,
mm-hmm,
and how it was inappropriate tactically and otherwise to use it during the strike.
Mm-hmm.
And also about the pace of the leadership relative to the rank and file. You had talked about that briefly.
Mm-hmm.
And also an excerpt from your discussion with Whitey Friday.
Mm-hmm.
So those those are some of the...
Well, I'm pleased.
We'll see what the article looks like.
When is it going to be published?
Well, I don't think he's absolutely sure. He...
Is it in the near future?
Yes, it will be in the near future. He's kind of been put under a speed-up situation in that he was made temporary business editor.
What are they getting it ready for, the stock market crash?
I don't know. My God, I hate to think. But he doesn't like it either. So,
no, 50 years ago, I meant.
Oh, I'm not sure why he's doing it, other than that he's interested in labor issues, and he said he was going through the morgue at the newspaper and finding the kind of coverage that he saw on the strike.
I think that will confirm my appraisal of what I thought of the coverage.
Yeah, well, he felt that it was just
very prejudiced.
Yes, very one-sided and incomplete.
Not right.
He wanted to round out the picture and give a side that has not yet been seen. So we were, we felt very pleased to be working with him.
Mm-hmm. No, you got my article that I sent you about Mary?
I did. Thank you very, very much. And I made a copy of it and gave one to...
I figured you could because, I know you was mailing a whole bunch of copies.
Oh, yeah. I do appreciate that very much. I also sent a copy of it to... Wayne Johnson, who's the research director for Joint Council 32.
Mm-hmm.
So that he's our liaison.
Mm-hmm. Who?
Dwayne Johnson.
Dwayne Johnson. I wonder where his roots are.
Don't know.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what craft he come from.
I don't know. I really don't know anything about that.
I don't know many of the present leaders there either.
So anyway, that's a scoop.
Mm-hmm.
Monahan and
well, I'm glad. I hope that they'll give it a fair shot at least.
I think there's a real good chance that he will. We've met with him a few times and it seems like a good person. So.
You know, there seems to be, to me, an accelerated interest, whether or not it's coupled with the 50th anniversary of the stock market crash, or whether the impending situation in the country bodes a stormy way to go. I don't know, but it seems to me that there's an unusual amount of interest editorial-wise in the country today.
Well, I don't know. Do you think it has anything to do with the fact that some unions that have traditionally been so conservative are all of a sudden making very radical statements?
Well, there's some movement, you know. You're familiar with what happened in California the other day. John Enning, the executive secretary of the AFL-CIO, which is about 1.5 million people, 1.25 million, something like that, issued a proclamation to the effect that we labor unions should divorce themselves from the Republican and the Democratic Party and launch out with a party of their own. If you don't have that, I'll be forwarded to you.
Sure, I would like to see that.
I'll send you a clipping. I have a lot of papers and magazines that I subscribe to and I read.
Yeah, I can tell you do.
And I follow the thing pretty closely. So I picked this one up out of one of the radical papers, but the text of the thing is there and their comments on it.
Uh-huh.
So I'll just put that in the mail. I'll photocopy it and mail it on to you.
Good. Well, had in mind the full-page ad that the building trades put out in the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee's magazine to the effect that the conventional parties were not serving the interests.
That's right, they're not. And I tell you, the whole method, and I don't care, I'd say it openly, which I've always said all my life, everything openly, that the bureaucracy that's entrenched in the not only in the AFL, but in the UAW and the Teamsters, is so blind to what's going on with the workers. My goodness, you're going in here and committing the workers to stand by for 6% and 7% inflation and hog-tying them and the tremendous profits and productivity that's becoming out of this thing is so tremendous. And their rights now... can you imagine the Supreme Court going to decide cases? The trade union movement is not fighting on behalf of OSHA, weak as it is. They're taking it tongue-in-cheek, and they're going along like them old clods were there supporting Olson in Minneapolis. They're all there, they're deifying the establishment. And I think there has to be something come of it, because boy, oh boy, people... And look at the duration of these strikes, the local Teamster strikes here. The employers belong to an association, and we had the same thing in Minneapolis. They're suing the unions for millions of dollars and going to get after the employers for breaking ranks. They can't conduct their own businesses.
Well, do you think that, I mean, we're seeing, you know, the more traditional or conservative unions taking a more militant stance now?
Some of them are.
Yeah, some of them are.
And it's coming from the ranks.
Yeah. Well, do you think that part of the thing that's increasing the amount of attention given to labor and the labor movement now, that in terms of newspaper articles and so forth, has to do with the fact that more people are being affected by economic conditions?
I think that's what's doing it. When you're out of a job and you can't work, you start to wonder why. When you've got a job, you know, and I don't think much of this UAW settlement, I don't think that was any kind of a victory. It was par for the course, dollars and cents to keep going, partly with the increased costs of everything passed on to the worker that buys the cars. And the top leaders of the unions are going to have to understand that there's going to have to be a change made in their approach. Carter has been miserable in what he's done and what his campaign promises. If you just take Carter's campaign promises and go right down the line, he's failed on every one of them. And everybody was around hoorah on Carter. And now they got that lame duck second mate or whatever he was, Lane Kirkland, that's going to now probably head the AFL, and he's worse than Meany. So there's going to have to be some changes. And a lot of the union officials are so smug and so circumspect that they don't want to respect it.
Well, in terms of that issue, do you think that the leadership of the AFL-CIO is... some people have said that it's getting older and that these people are simply going to die out and fade away and that thereby live in a place for the younger people. Do you think that theory has any merit?
Well, I tell you, it's kind of like politician who gets elected to Congress and he's going to go in there and change things. And they housebreak him pretty quick. And the people that are coming up through the ranks in the AFL, what I can see of it, I don't think there's going to be much improvement. It's going to have to be something more radical than what they're going along with all this conservative. After all, the people in this country, the 85% that they call the working gent, is entitled to some part and some say in the laws. And the laws in this country are being manipulated. The giant corporations and these conglomerates and multinational companies, they're just manipulating this country, and we're subsidizing them in every turn of the road. Look at this big fiasco they've got here. They're going to give. Now, I believe that the people in the Northeast part of the United States should be granted some consideration on their heat bills. What they claim is going to run an increase of $500 over last year. But why shouldn't we just restrict the profits of the oil companies? Because when they give them $1 billion in some form of aid or subsidy, all we're doing is maintaining the tremendous, horrendous profits that the oil companies are making. There's no need for that. And so it means that if we're going to give subsidy, it's a kind of an inverted nationalization of the industry. I'm with my tax dollar, I'm paying now to carry on the tremendous profits of these oil cartels. That's the way I look at it. Of course, I come from a little bit left to center, you know.
Yeah. Hmm? Well, I guess that, you know, all of these factors do figure into, to the mood of the country. And
that's right.
To the mood of the people who can assess what's going on in a public way, like reporters.
Yeah, and look at the flagrant disregard of, we go through this weak sister National Labor Relations Board, and the big employer said, well, to hell with that, by your leave. I submit the J.P. Stevens, the Coors Beer, that big shipyard Tenneco, the big bank company here, 6,300 tellers that have been approved and certified and recertified. All they do is get in legal hassles for years, hope to drive the militants out, the radicals out, and repopulate it with a bunch of suck-holing, subservient people that are just happy to get a job. They don't have any respect for the laws of this country. They never did. And we see the censorships now of some of these old, staid, Democratic leaders in Congress, Thurmond and a few more that are being now censored, and another one up, and all kind of crooks. The people are getting disgusted with it. Must be. There's some reason for it.
Do you think that, you know, given all this, do you think that there's any place in the future for leaders, labor leaders like Ed Sadlowski and Psaki or Lipsinger? Are these people
going to
survive?
You said Sadlowski from the steelworkers.
Yeah.
And who else?
Psaki. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but he's with the oil, chemical, and atomic workers.
Oh, Victor, you mean?
Pardon me?
Is his first name Victor?
Maybe. It's either Victor or John.
Well, they are an improvement over... They are an improvement over some of the people that are now in the union. And I don't know, because I'm not privy to that on an intimate basis, I don't know how far they're going to go, but I think that the answer is going to be needed for the American people is going to have to be a complete departure, where the oligarchies, the big corporations, are going to control this country. And I don't know how far Sadlowski will go. And I know he made a good run in the steel workers, and I don't know how far he's committed to make a clean out-and-out break with the tradition that you got to have two parties.
Well, do you think that, that these people, in the stance that they are taking, go far enough, or do you see them as a necessary element in the transitional period between what has been and what will be?
Well, they may be part of a transition. I don't think that any of them that I have seen come right out and measure up right four square the way I would like to see it done.
What about Whippensinger?
Hmm?
He just said that he was a socialist.
Who?
Whippensinger.
Whippensinger?
Yeah.
Yeah, but when you get Whippensinger right down, boy, he'll run like hell when you want to pin him down about the two-party system. He talks good, and he's a good propaganda man for those people in the unions that want to say, well, he said it, and by God, he's right. He's going to serve a role there. But he and Fraser and a few more, they've been so long identified with this, well, we'll go in and talk tough to the Democrats because they're better than the Republicans, and Kennedy's better than Carter, and I don't see that at all. Kennedy is going to be just like Carter as the days get longer. And those guys that are born with $1 million and a silver spoon, regardless of how vaudevillian you are in their approach to things, are still going to represent the interests that they come from. It's just as natural as night and day. And there has to be some clean breaks made with those people, and I haven't seen that. Maybe they'll come to that. Whippensinger, if all the things that he says he wants to do, he speaks out. But when he gets right down to the, you know, when you break the tape on him, he's always in the stretch someplace, but never at the tape. He never comes in and says right out, this is what's got to be done, and I'm for doing it. It's going to take somebody with courage to do it. They may develop out of this. But the force of the ranks may push them that way. But many of the things that Whippensinger says are needed and should be. And I don't think he's so all that extreme in many of his approaches. He's just common sense, a lot of it. But he hasn't yet, or Fraser either, squared right up to the real big issue and says, by God, it's enough is enough, and now we go. Those that want to join, come on with us, we'll go. They haven't reached that point yet.
Would that be suicide?
No, I don't think so. I think so. It's no more suicide than what we done in Minneapolis.
Uh-huh.
You just got to have the courage. You know, the Wobblies used to have a poem on their paper that says, as from this hour, you know your power. Uh-huh. Believe and dare and do. The world must follow you. And I'll write that out for you if you like. But there's a lot of merit in that. And if they've got the courage of their convictions, some of these guys may have to toy with the idea that maybe they're going to lose their $100,000 to $150,000 a year income with all the privileges.
Right. Well, you know, the thing that I keep thinking of is like what you were telling me last time we spoke about the leadership being careful to keep pace with the rank and file so that they did not move so far
right
into the future that the rank and file could be with them. It's almost like you're talking about an organic development that's happening. It's an evolution, and that at a certain point, people are able to act decisively and, you know, in a sense, radically.
Well, of course, what goes with that is leadership's role, that you have to have some courage. And you have to have some thoughts and some ideas, and you have to put them out and tell the people why you believe they're good. And on the basis of the merit of your explanation and your program, why you get the support. I don't think that the leadership should wait for the last guy, the wiper on the ship, to chart the course, you know. They have a duty, too, to lead.
So it has to come...
Well, it's a kind of a joint effort. those that are in leadership in working class organizations have an obligation to the ranks to be posted and to advise them of what's going on and how they see it, because they're full-time executives. And if they do more of that than jaunting around the country having all these great backslapping meetings and big banquets and things like that, and talk to the ranks and not the pie cards, I think they'd go a lot farther. You know, the very idea, the Western Conference of Teamsters held a meeting here with 1,400 delegates from all the various unions or whatever, but the rank and file people that are in this city couldn't attend because they weren't a delegate. Now, all the officialdom and everyone else was permitted, but I talked to some of the Teamsters on the streets here. Our union, the International Longshoremen's Union, anyone can come. And it's open. And if they say, well, it'd be too many people, well, then get bigger halls. That's the answer.
Well, that certainly marks a distinction when he approaches, doesn't it?
It does. It sure does. This idea of restricting the people and making the leaders anointed with a certain amount of insight and knowledge that the ranks don't have, don't get it with me. And while a lot of people called Harry Bridges all sorts of names and pointed out the flaws in his approach to many things, there's one thing that you could never take away from him. He believed in the open discussion, let the ranks see what's going on. And no closed sections, no elaborate executive board meetings in fancy spas or in Bell Harbor, Florida, or over in the Puerto Rican Islands or some of those places where the average worker never can get. Not so. And the International Longshoremen's Union, and I don't want to be an ILWU patriot here, they kept moving the convention. Every 2 years is moved to the cities where the men are. And in the event that the local unions in that particular locality can't fund it, there's a fund set up in the union so that to the smallest local union could host an international convention. And those are things that are developed out of the 1934 strikes, where the workers have a say in their union, not just the leadership. Why, the very idea of unions holding meetings 4 and 5 times a year, that's a vital thing to hold the union meetings. And I know so many unions, Teamsters included, and all the bigger unions. Why, in the summertime, we don't hold no meetings. We can't get nobody to attend. People will attend if they're interested. Now, I never saw anyone yet that didn't go. So if you make the meetings such that there's nothing there to consider and don't give them a voice, why go there?
Well, do you think that the administration of union business has changed so much over the years that that people who are in the position of running unions no longer have the skills to run meetings? I mean, basic skills like running meetings and drawing in people and delegating responsibilities and keeping people active. Have they lost those skills?
I don't know if they've lost them, but I think they feel that it enables their continuity in office not to get into that area. Maybe some of them still have it. But I look around, even in our union, I look around at the old job stewards, the reaction on the job, and this idea of, well, let's take a case in point. Let's take the Teamsters Union. It's become very big, tremendous in size, and I know that. But the grievances, they've got such an elaborate system of grievance now that it takes years, months, if not years, to resolve a grievance. And the guys get PO'd before they even get started. They say, oh, what the hell's the use? And you go through the local chairs, all unions have departed from the old job action style, and I don't say the job action is a complete answer, but there has to be some understanding that the people on the job that are involved in the beefs have some understanding. Now, the union to which I belong for years, we have the business agents night or day on the call, and they come down and they respond to the job. And we have regular meetings of the grievance committees, and the men are still active. And even this union is getting involved in such an elaborate. The employers in the country are deliberately, the men in the three-button suits, you know, the union busters, They've schemed up this big elaborate grievance machinery, which makes it so formidable that you need a Philadelphia lawyer to process a complaint whether or not a driver should be paid 2 extra hours because he was out 2 extra hours.
Uh-huh.
Huh? They've got it on all this gibberish. If I can look it up here, I'll send you a photocopy of an article that was picked up and run in our union paper, but published by some other union, the men in the three-button suits, the union busters. And these forums that they're having around the country, where hundreds of dollars are required for roster fee, and they're telling people how to defeat the unions. Now, in our day, we would be there with picket lines, and we'd be there with banners and demonstrations and everything else, letting the world know what it was up to.
This attack from the right is such a broad issue.
Yeah, and it's so subtle. And most of these pie cards, as I call them, because I can't think of a better one.
What did you call it?
Pie cards. P-I-E hyphen C-A-R-D-S. It's an old, old-time expression for people that are in on the pie. Pie cards. It's a kind of a, it's not hardly what you call a congratulatory description of a fellow who's got more of his body hanging over his belt than he has in it. They call them pie cards. And it's an expression that's not used much anymore. But too many of them are caught up in that. And they want to be seen down at the business agents' luncheons, or they want to be at the Fathers of the City conferences. But the IWW had a preamble that said the working class and the employing class got nothing in common. And I don't see how you can represent both the union and the employer. And when I see that being done, then I'd like to know who it is. Eugene Debs could never do it. You either are with the workers and you fight their cause, and you don't see no turncoats in the employer class. They're always attacking the union. They're class conscious, most employers, and most union people are not. The officials, they feel that they have to sit on top of the boiler and keep the guys inside of it.
Well, would you say that part of the problem in today in terms of internal problems is that being a union official or acting in the union is such a political thing to do, that often people's goals get subverted?
If I get the thrust of what you're saying, my opinion is that so many people in trade unions say, we're a trade union, we're not involved in politics, but they themselves get wrapped up in this little 2x4 war-dealing politics to the end they don't know if they're coming or going. And it's time they quit that. It's time that they start in and start to analyze what rights the workers have. Look at this thing that's being hoisted on us now on the grounds of nuclear plants. And here you have business agents running around from many of the national unions. And what are they looking for? Well, we get jobs out of it. Isn't that an awful thing to say? Building the ovens in Hitler's Germany was, they give job to the bricklayers too. But what's the purpose of the job? And these are the things that bother me. And you can get in some awful fights with some of these union officials on the grounds that we're going to protect the two-party system, and we got to have capitalism, and we got to have this. Well, when capitalism ceases to function for the purpose of the people, then maybe we better take another look around and see what it'll do in its place. And I'm not ready at the moment to say that it's a simple matter to say, well, we'll go from white to black. You don't do that. But most of them are not concerned. They want to take a stick and get after the guy who stands up in the union meeting, wants an investigation of the gas crunch, wants to know why, and you just had an evidence of it there, everybody, the media and everybody else down in Red Wing. The nuclear plant is leaking gas. The fact of the matter is they're not foolproof and they can leak. And in the University Daily at the time of Three Mile Island, they had a cartoon there where the guy was half withered away, and it was, says it was just a little leak. How do you measure little leaks and big leaks? We don't need nuclear energy.
Well, it's all part of the sham that's going on.
And they're going to make this state a storehouse for all the scrap. I don't know what the governor said there this morning on it, but he said something about his position hadn't changed, the new governor of Minnesota. I don't know what his position is on nuclear energy.
Well, I think that he is inclined to consider first and foremost the business interests of the state.
Yeah, well, that means we'll have nuclear energy, just like our governor here. She's been on the Atomic Commission, Governor Dixie Lee Ray.
Right.
And all she can hack out is that there's been no deaths. How can people say that?
Yeah.
I don't know what they mean by a death, but there has to be, the coroner has to come to the body, pick it up and say this person died as a result of a gas leak in Red Wing. Well, what about the history of all the people in the nuclear areas? And what about in Japan, and what's happened to all the soldiers and all the sheep and all those people that made that film, The Conquerors, and Karen Silkwood and a few more? Can you imagine the audacity of someone wanting a sensible person to believe a woman took home a contaminated sandwich and put it in her icebox? Why, just...
Well, yeah, it's amazing that they would even utter those words.
Why, of course. It's an insult to any sensible person's intelligence. Now, there's a lot of people here that want to commit Harry Carrier. They had kamikaze pilots in the war and everything. But it's not the... Life is pretty dear, and people will fight to hang on. No one's going to go home and put radioactive sandwiches in their icebox so they know if they eat enough of them, they'll die quicker than if they wouldn't. Eat them.
Yeah, absurd.
It's absurd. It's just... Incidentally, my niece is working in a federal judge's office there. Judge Riley, is it?
Uh-huh.
That's where she's working.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was glad that you sent me that article about her defending that group of...
Yeah, well, I think she's done more than that, but I just got that. One of my nieces sent it to me.
Yeah, that's good. She sounds like a pretty active person.
Yes, I haven't seen her for many years, but she's pretty well grounded.
Yeah. And I also appreciated that poem you sent, the lutefisk.
Oh, the blue-eyed lutefisk, yeah, bet you.
That was cute. I could just imagine you saying it, too.
Well, we have quite a Scandinavian community here, you know, like Minneapolis.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, Ballard, you better have to see the Norwegian Council to rent a house out there.
Oh, my.
Oh, yes.
Mm.
And they have great doings, and they have the big Norwegian parades, and it's another Cedar Avenue used to be. We used to call that Snooze Boulevard many years ago in my youth. That whole south side, you know, is predominantly Scandinavian. But out in Ballard, it's even more than that. And we got the big fishing fleets here that they don't have, you know.
Uh-huh.
We got all the, what they call the second growth Norwegians and some of the old timers yet that come direct here from Norway, and they do have the big clubs here and everything else.
Well, so in that sense, it's not that much different from Minneapolis, is it?
No, it's very similar.
Well, so
I was just going to say the same thing, that maybe we ought to get going with the topic at hand instead of soapboxing, huh?
Oh, I don't know. I like this.
I do, too.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Last week we were...
We'd come to question that I have itemized as question 44. Do you recall any internal union problems at this time?
Right.
Now, just a moment, and there we get into Cliff Hall and a few more. And I noticed that in the balance of your questions, there were a whole lot of problems that were internal, and I don't know how we're going to address them, because we don't have any continuity established here to follow it. It's kind of going to be at random, And perhaps maybe if you would lead out here and have what you have in mind.
Well, there, I think there might be two ways to approach it. Since you know the history, you're going to have to help me in this.
Very well.
Way. We could approach it chronologically. We could, in the sense of incident by incident, or we could approach it in terms of the individuals involved.
Yeah, well,
just tell me about the most important.
Why don't we try to do it on the basis of a general thing?
Okay.
And then if you want to get into more direct or personality things, why, you sing out.
Okay.
Now, we had left. See, there's a period from the time we got the strike headquarters back until the strike was settled. It was a very hectic period. There was some internal problems, granted. There were external problems that were also very, very significant. And they came from all sides, and it was a very hectic period for the union. And the union leadership had a hell of a job there to keep the show on an even road so that we could steer the course. Now, if we want to talk about the internal things, and let's follow the internal problem, let's take the most direct one within the union. After we got the headquarters back, and now we'd had the shooting, we'd buried John Ballore, some of the guys were coming out of the hospital, the military permits were encroaching on the activity.
Okay, we're talking about late July and early August then.
Well, it would be, yes, it would be in August now.
Okay.
The military permits were wrecking their havoc. There were more and more of these things being issued indiscriminately. And there was some, after the meetings with Olson, where Kelly and Ray and I and Grant and Farrell had put the route to some of the more conservative AFL labor leaders, they started, obviously, to do their scheming in the back room. They got kind of repulsed there and sat down publicly. Now, I believe that some of these guys, like I've told you before, thought they were doing the best, probably in their own point of view, that by us striking out would strike out at Olson, and striking out at Olson would hurt the image of the Farm Labor Party. Now, that may have been the background for some of the thinking. Some of it was just plain redneck thinking. Now, Cliff Hall, he was the business agent of the union. And he'd been held in check pretty much because of the day-to-day activities of the strike committee. Well, he met... See, the executive board of the union, we should understand that, was composed of Bill Brown, George Frozig, Babe Nolan, Bill Gray, Sammy Haskell, and Mo Hork. There were seven of them. Bill and George were outstanding in there. George Frozig, he was a Dane. And Bill Brown, they were outstanding in their understanding. Mo Hork, who'd been, well, not, I say, sympathetic, but who had been not a follower, but he'd been more supportive of Cliff Hall than in the early days. He was changing his opinions of things because of the practical realization. Sammy Haskell, Babe Nolan. Bill Gray was a good old guy. Well, they used to hold executive board meetings. See, the affairs of the union, through the strike committee and the negotiating committee, the affairs of the union were an everyday thing. Well, Cliff Hall would meet, we had an attorney, his name was John Goldie, G-O-L-D-I-E. He was down there on 4th Street and 2nd Avenue South in that building, I forget what the name of it was. Well, they used to hold their meetings down there, Sammy Haskell, Babe Nolan, Cliff Hall, and I forget the other lad. And Sam Haskell was the the Secretary Treasurer of the Union. I think Babe Nolan was the recording secretary. Well, they used to go down there and hold the King's Court. They didn't have any workers down there, but they had themselves. And they'd cut up the scores, so to speak. Well, between them and some of the other AFL leaders that were quietly holding a grudge against what we had done to them, they felt, were starting the red baiting stuff now. They started to shoot away. And at one state, they put out a statement answering the red baiting attacks that was been carried in the paper. I remember that, and they were censored for that. And the strike committee and the negotiating committee, which was basically Dobbs, Skogie, and Ray Dunn, Bill Brown, they felt that all this red baiting shouldn't even be dignified by an answer. The members of the union were not reds, it was just an attack. Well, they issued that. Then Cliff Hall announced that they were going to close up the headquarters. Now, the strike was in progress. And he proposed that the rent for the month of August, I think it would be, couldn't be paid because we didn't have the money. What a laugh. What a laugh. The strike was costing the union about at least $1,000 to $1,500 a day to run. The rent was probably $250 a month. And he come up with a remark that there wasn't any money to pay the rent, so we'd have to close the strike headquarters. Well, this set off a ruckus.
Why would he make such an obvious a statement that so obviously would invoke the wrath of people around him?
Well, he was a firm believer to be a labor statesman, and he was looking around at the antics of William Green and Sam Gompers and some more of them. That was his background. And he didn't like something, why he felt that no one else had a right to say anything.
Was there any possibility that he could produce anything that might serve as proof?
No, nothing.
True?
Nothing. He was just, he saw that there was no place for him. First, remember, he was not a member of Local 574, which is a hard thing to overcome. He was a business agent. He was a hired hand, which is the right of the union to hire or to fire the business agent. That's the constitution of the Teamsters Union. There was nothing wrong in what that was done, but he come from Local 471, the Milk Wagon Drivers Union. And he replaced a fellow by the name of Milo. I think it was Milo Peterson. And, of course, you see, there was no written contracts with the general driving industry, but there were written contracts with most of the dairies in Minneapolis. The industry was pretty well organized, not completely. So he had a job where he couldn't be discriminated against, and he was going to... He couldn't break into the hierarchy of labor statesmanship in Local 471. Pat Corcoran and Emory Nelson and Bill Sinnott and Gene Larson had that nailed down. So he was looking around to be, I suppose, another Sam Gompers. And the only place he could go was a part-time job. He didn't work full-time for the union. He worked in the afternoons as business agent. He didn't understand the driving industry from the standpoint of the truck driver. He didn't have any concept of the more radical ideas that we entertained on the industrial union shop and everybody to be involved. He couldn't comprehend that. Although the Milk Wagon Drivers Union was semi-industrial itself, it took the inside workers and the drivers and the plant workers and the stablemen and the whole bunch. They had a lot of horses those days. But he didn't understand it that way. So he just was striking out anything he could to discredit people. I guess he felt that if we shut up the strike headquarters, I believe that he saw that a successful conclusion of the strike would eliminate Cliff Hall's position as business agent. And he'd do everything he could to hamstring the union. He'd take the books home at night, and I remember Farrell sent Don Tutty and I and Kelly Postle out to get him one night, because all the records he just take there. And he was working part-time on his job as a milk wagon driver. So he was going to shut the hall down. He was going to not pay the rent. And he relied on the fact that the executive board had made these decisions. Well, we had to get the strike committee together. And, you know, the funny part of it was the strike committee, by virtue of office, the executive board of the union was automatically there. And if they had anything to say, they could say it there, but they used to hold these little meetings down in John Goldie's office or someplace else. And although we had an office of the union, I don't think they used that. But nevertheless, he decided that we wouldn't be able to pay the rent. And away we went. And we had a big rhubarb there. Now that was the one side of it. That was internal so far as Cliff Hall was concerned. When we had him up in front of the strike committee instructed him that the membership of the union was going to conduct the strike and not him or the executive board. They had an open and democratic right to voice any opinion and have it argued in the strike committee. But the negotiating committee and the executive board were subservient to the strike committee. And Carl got up and took a kick at him too, and he pointed out that the membership was the supreme authority. So we kept the hall. We kept it going. But he was going to move us out of there.
Okay, clearly at least some members of the executive board were in agreement with the strike committee.
Yes, Bill Brown, George Froese, Lock, Stock, and Barrel.
Okay.
Mohawk. And Bill Gray.
Okay.
Now the other four were with Cliff Hall.
Uh-huh.
Or the other three. Babe Nolan, Sammy Haskell. And you know, for the life of me, I can't figure out the seventh man.
Well, maybe I can find it in my records.
Well, it would have to be. I don't have access to those records anymore. Whatever the executive board was, there'd be a letterhead around or something.
Yes. Uh-huh.
But whoever that fellow was, he was a... Casper Melk, those two. He was lined up with Cliff Hall.
Uh-huh.
There was three of them.
Uh-huh.
There was Sammy Haskell and Babe Nolan. Those two I remember for sure.
Okay, is that Nolan?
N-O-L-A-N. He was a driver for the Minneapolis Star.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I forget what his first name was. They called him Babe. He had a nickname.
Uh-huh.
Now that part, that was the internal within Local 574. Now, I can't tell you chronologically what days all of this occurred, but this was in the period, the time that we got returned to the strike headquarters until the strike was settled.
Now, you indicated that the executive board, during the normal course of things, would hold meetings separate from the strike committee.
Well, I wouldn't say in the normal course of things.
Oh, okay.
The normal course of things was to conduct the affairs of the union via the strike committee. That's where everyone was there.
But apparently there were some separate executive board meetings.
Well, what they were rump meetings, as we called them.
What meetings?
Yeah. They didn't have the full executive board. They didn't have Froese and Bill Brown there.
Just a second, I'll tape. Just a second.
Wait, let me get a glass of water then.
Seattle, Washington, October 3rd, 1979. This is side two, the second part of two tapes, an interview with Professor Martin Duffy and Christine Miller, research analyst, University of Minnesota, Labor Education Service, concerning the Minneapolis General Driver Strike of 1934.
Now, they weren't regular executive board meetings. We called them rump meetings because Bill Brown and Bill Gray And George Froese and Mo Hork were not in attendance.
Oh.
And they would issue these statements in the name of the executive board.
The remaining people would, like Sammy Haskell and...
Sammy Haskell and Babe Nolan and Cliff Hall.
Okay.
Now, where they used to meet most of the time was down in the attorney's office, John Goldie.
Uh-huh.
They'd come in there, I suppose, whenever they decided to come in there. But they weren't up in the strike headquarters. They weren't around there hardly at all. Sammy was down. He was the financial secretary, secretary treasurer of the union, and he was down keeping the book straight. That was his argument.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to make sure he was legal, so I guess he consulted John Goldie.
Mm-hmm.
And wherever Cliff Hall, and he was the, actually, Cliff Hall was the business agent of the union. Because the original executive board of the union prior to 1934 had hired Cliff Hall at some date to be the business agent. And they had never fired him.
Mm-hmm.
That come later.
Why do you think they never fired him?
Well, at that time, the majority of the executive board were, well, they didn't have the guts to do what was needed in the city. And I won't, maybe that's wrong to say they didn't have the guts. It didn't seem that the time was exactly right.
Did it ever appear during the course of the strike that perhaps Cliff Hall wasn't such a bad guy or was actually aiding the strike cause? I mean, was there any uncertainty, or did he always seem to be on the wrong side?
Well, from my point of view, he was always on the wrong side. He got out of bed in the morning on the wrong side, and he stayed that way till he went back to bed. And most of the other guys felt that way. But now, in all organizations, you have groups. And there was a few guys in the union that supported Cliff Hall because they were of this type that they find a way to get along, and they was happy to go to a business agent's meeting once a week or something like that, and walk around as some sort of statesman. Now, there's some guys that have that feeling today. Then, too. Well, some of the fellows, there wasn't many of them. Damn few. But at the time that Cliff Hall was hired as business agent of the union, the membership of the union was about 150 men. And no one could afford. The union didn't have enough money to pay a guy full time. If Cliff Hall would have worked for what the union could afford full time, he couldn't have done it either. He was a part-time guy. He had a milk wagon job in the morning. So it was a question of having a business agent. I never saw the stinker around trying to organize anybody. He was always up in the office. He had a suit on and a necktie and a white shirt. And he was always sitting up there writing letters. I never saw him out on the streets, out on the docks or anything, although he did work as a milk wagon driver or inside worker or something. He was on a truck part of the time. But they'd hold these little rump meetings, we called them. Froesig and Bill Brown, they would never have went for that stuff, and neither would Mo Hork. When once Mo Hork saw what the score was, Mo wasn't vicious in support of Cliff Hall. He felt, well, hell, maybe that's the best we can do, and so on. He was kind of tolerant. But Sammy Haskell and Nolan, they were cut out of the same cloth as Cliff Hall. Yeah. Now, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so.
Now we had another shot. When we started to organize, and this I have to be general, when we started to organize, we said anybody that's not organized that wants to join the union, we'll take them in the industry. Well, we lined up, we were out after, of course, the tank drivers in the oil companies. So we lined up some of them, not all of them. We lined up some. And we also lined up lots of filling station attendants that worked. Now, today, there's very few hired workers in the filling stations. It's mostly lessees, they call them. Or you got a cashier in a self-serve station. But those days, the big oil companies had hired workers. Standard Oil and Texaco and Phillips and a few more, they had hired people. They were employees working for wages. And there were a lot of independent filling station owners. So we lined them up. Anyone that wanted to join, we took them in. And they were in the process of forming demands and trying to meet with the local employers on their problems. And during the time that we were raided, we used these friendly gasoline stations as curbstone strike headquarters, as I told you earlier. Many of them were very friendly and were members of our union. Also, there used to be in Minneapolis Local 125. That was the taxi cab drivers union. Now, today, everything is done. You come into a city, you've got a car waiting for you. It's a lease car, and you don't even use a taxi cab or the bus most times to get to the city anymore. Most travelers, commercial travelers, rent a car, right? And that's the style. Well, those days, the traveling salesman used to come to town on the train. There wasn't no airplanes that they were using. And there'd be a baggage truck take his samples up to the Radisson or in one of the better hotels, and they'd have some showrooms there. And the salesman would hire a car to haul them around town. Well, some of the taxi cab companies had what they call blacktop cars, that there were just private cars, and others used to use taxi cabs. And there was the yellow cab, which was a big fleet-owned cab. Old man Daly was running the show there. And then there was a whole bunch of independent owner cars, like the Liberty, the Blue and White. There were two or three big companies. The guy with the Rios, I'm trying to think of his name, he was down on 2nd Avenue, and Red Top and Yellow, they were all fleet drivers. But Liberty, Blue and White, and the Minnesota cab, that was, the Kraft brothers had that, they used to have some of their own cars, but mostly they were individuals that owned their own cars. And some of them drove the car themselves and just single shifted it, as they called it. And others had cars where they had drivers working on commission. And they had a taxi cab drivers union, but for the most part it was weak and ineffective. And they catered to the independent owners in this taxi cab drivers union. They didn't want the yellow fleet in and everything, because actually, what they done, it was another patronage thing. They wanted to keep a certain amount of work among themselves, and they felt that the fleet drivers would interfere with it. So, the yellow drivers joined our union, 574, and a good share of them. And we worked out an agreement with them for a yellow cab company. Now, we didn't work out anything for Red Top, or for them, trying to think, Jim Hawks or something had a bunch of cars there. We didn't work out an agreement with them. But we did have an agreement worked out with Yellow. And most of the taxi cab drivers come into 574. Now, over in St. Paul was a vice president of the Teamsters Union, an old gentleman named John Gary. Well, about the time that Cliff Hall was attacking the union one way, John Gary come over on the streetcar, and he started pussyfooting around there, agitating some of these cab drivers to break away and sign an agreement with the taxi cab drivers. That was one shot that was coming. And almost, you might say, simultaneously, some dude come in representing an AFL union that had jurisdiction for the filling station attendants. And they were going to try to bargain for the filling station unions. And I remember there was a meeting. Now, I didn't go to that meeting, but several of the other guys did, and finally this fellow left. And I don't remember his name now, because it was, I have no reason to remember. I do remember Hall and Gary. Those were internal problems. Now, what they done, they constituted serious problems for the leadership of the union. Not only for Ray and for Carl and for Dobbs, but for the strike committee and the negotiating committee, because here's people chipping away claiming they represented you. Now, in addition to all of that, the employers were going into court to get an injunction against martial law. All these things were going on almost what you might say simultaneously. And then to top it off, here comes Hawes Dunnigan now. And they want to water down their proposal. Now, I told you earlier that in our meetings with Floyd Olson and his stand that what he was trying to do was get the rank and file committee up there to settle the strike for less than, I suppose, what the Hawes Dunnigan agreement provided for. Now, I don't know for what reason, but here was Hawes and Dunnigan and Olson had got together and said, this is a fine agreement, and this is what we recommend. Now they come back and they wanted to water down their own agreement. And I remember the one big thing that concerned me was that the employer would not have to rehire strikers in accordance with any rules. He'd take them back as he wanted them back. Now, earlier we had fought against any person that was convicted of any or accused of any violence, as they call it. You could be hit on the head with a cop and you get hauled into the hospital, well, then you were engaged in a fight, and that's violence. Would not be rehired whatsoever. And I think that was the big thing with me.
The threat of people who have been involved in the strike.
What does violence mean? What a strike activity would not be rehired. And there were also, I think there was something to do with the wages. They backed away from the minimum wage. You know, in the original Hawes Dunnigan agreement, there were some provisions for minimum wages and a provision to elevate them later on. Now, all of that was going on during this period of time. So I don't know how much we're going to consider that to be internal problems in the union or external, but they certainly did affect the conduct of the strike. If any of those things would have been allowed, it would have been an unraveling process. And once it starts, who knows where it ends? And those were the problems. Now, as I recall, they didn't get the injunction. I don't think they ever come to pass. Whether they gave up or whether the court ruled against them, I definitely don't recall. Now, also, along about this time, and I was very emphatic in my last discussion with you that it was the Minneapolis Harness Bulls that done the shooting. And I told you at the beginning, because you propounded a question one time, were there thugs? and I told you that I had never seen them. And to this day, I can't recall seeing them. But I do recall that after the raid on the Citizens Alliance, they produced some evidence that thugs, they'd been contacting some of the notorious strike-breaking agencies to bring in thugs to Minneapolis.
Like
who? Huh?
Like who?
Well,
you think the Pinkertons?
Well, yeah, or Bergdorf or Pinkerton.
Mm-hmm.
We always called them in the labor movement thugs, because that's what they were. They were mercenaries.
Mm-hmm.
You could hire them for four bits more than I paid them if you had that kind of money.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd do the same job for you as they would do for me.
Mm-hmm.
And you could be on one side of the fence and me on another. They didn't care. They were hiring. They were mercenaries. We just called them thugs. They weren't to be dignified with a high-class word like mercenary. And they were to be, there were some talks that they were going to bring it in. Now, the allegation was that Olson, with martial law, was not doing the job for the employers. And they thought they could do it better with thugs. But to this day, I never saw them. To say that they weren't there, I couldn't say that they were not. I never saw them. Now, some of the people contend that they were in evidence, but they hadn't been utilized, which is quite likely. I know that they were used in the Flower City strike a few months later, in 1935. But in Minneapolis, I never saw them used. And all of this is going on, and of course, Olson, each day, he's under more pressure all the time, and each day, more and more, these goddamn military permit trucks are running. So we had all sorts of internal pressure. And also, there was another thing. Some of the strikers were getting weary. You know, there was a tremendous job the union had to do. We had to keep the strike kitchen going. We had all the other problems, hustling that money. There were thousands of people that were fed every day, and people were getting evicted from their houses and their furniture. It was a real concerted effort by the Minneapolis employers, with the direction of the Citizens Alliance, to harass the hell out of the strikers. And guys were getting thrown out and getting moved, and well, it was just a hell of a thing. Now, I don't know how you would say what's internal and what's external.
Well, you've really displayed how they overlap.
Yeah. Hmm? Now, they all kind of go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
And to get a picture of what was facing the union. Now, some of it was internal. Cliff Hall and John Gary, that was internal. And, that, of course, that come right from Tobin. And the guy from the AFL that come in there, I suppose that come from, well, I guess it was Bill Green that was ahead. Let's see, Sam Gompers, Bill Green. And who was the other guy that followed him? George Meany, wasn't it? Yeah. Bill Green had a hand in it. And there's no question that Tobin pushed him into that.
Yeah, I was also interested in that aspect of it, in terms of the leadership from the international level, and then from the AFL as well.
Yes.
What kind of internal problems their influence created.
Well, now there was a group of the, oh, by all means, when you touch on that now, the State Federation of Labor, was a guy by the name of Hall. No relation to Cliff Hall. But they went to the same pot to get their ideas. And he was openly condemning the union. He was condemning the industrial concept of the union. He took after the fact that, oh, how in the hell did he approach it? Well, we weren't living up to the old solid straight craft union line. And we were taking in everybody. And that's what we did. We made no bones about it. If they're not organized and nobody else is going to organize them, we will. We believe in industrial unionism. Well, he was attacking that. We went to the Minneapolis Central Labor Union, as I recall. We wanted at one point, not a general strike, but a demonstration. Because here, all the effort was being put on the union to water down the contract by Hawes and Dunnigan themselves, by Olson trying to get the rank and file committee to settle for less, by Olson using the troops to grant more and more military permits, and jailing more and more strikers every day, sometimes caught in an alleged act of violence, stopping a truck and asking them, that was just stopping a truck, was violence, according to the mandate of the marshal, the provost marshal. You were not to interfere. If the truck had a military permit on it, you were not to stop to dry and ask him what he was doing and try to persuade him to go back to the barn. That was an act of violence, and you went to the stockade for that. And of course, there were several hundred people over in the stockade, which created a problem too in the union. They couldn't visit over there, and they had some real fights in order to get in there. And when we went down, I was on one of the committees that went down to try to stop the military permits, and we got told that if we opened up our mouth anymore, we'd get hauled off to the stockade. Well, there was no point in that. And so we left, and there was other people as well. Now, Hall, he was the head of the... Now, when I talk about this guy, I forget what his name was. It wasn't Cliff Hall, but the other Hall. He was giving us the jab. When we went to the Central Labor Union in Minneapolis to get them to have a one-day demonstration, a solidarity, so forth, for the union. Because, you know, the union was... We was in a hell of a fight there. We'd been on strike 5 or 6 weeks. And there isn't any doubt that there were some of the men that were returning to work. They felt all was lost, and every day there was new attacks coming from, like I pointed out, various people.
Mm-hmm. And you needed their support.
And we wanted the rally, you know. And people that had been shot, and 2 deaths, and the funerals, and there was a lot of people had a kind of a pessimistic outlook. We'll never win. And that was beginning to, especially when you see officials like this president of the State Federation of Labor, and I forget who it was, I think it was T.E. Cunningham, who was head of the Central Labor Council, who were making these remarks. And then Bob Cramer, he was the writer for the paper, and what all he was trying to do was, he'd shut his mouth, the poor old guy, you know. He had so much adulation for Olson that everything Olson done, he tried to make it out as a mastermind of some super strategy. And every time you turned around, it seemed that there was more stuff being thrown at the leadership of the union, the conduct of the strike. And the Red Scare was being projected. And for the most part, the guys on the strike committee were solid to a man. Most of the knowledgeable members of the union were solid because it showed it. But there was a certain percentage that felt, well, we can't win. I might as well go back and get my job back. Now, some of them went back. And as the days went on, more and more guys went back. And we wanted a demonstration for one day. And the Central Labor Council didn't respond. And without them responding, it didn't give us much of a hand to get the state to make any declaration. Instead of that, Hall was really doing a job on the Union every time he could. And he'd make these off-the-record statements to the press or whatever, and they'd publish it. And there was attacks being run in the papers about the Reds in control of the Union. And the Union has no way to get back at it. And after all, how can you walk around and say, well, I ain't a Red. You know I'm not a Red. We just figured, hell, we ain't going to dignify that kind of tactic. But there was problems that the Union had at that time. And, of course, everyone was at the Union. Every day there was new problems. And that went on for, Jesus God, I remember those last days of the strike. Boy, they were pretty hairy. You know, I'm giving it to you here, not in a chronological manner. Now, I don't know which come first and which followed the other, but boy, they were all mixed up together. And they went on every day they were going on. And people getting jailed and people getting thrown out of their houses and people not being able to pay their light bills and their lights being shut off and the furniture company after their furniture, and about the only thing that prevented, I guess, more people from getting their furniture pulled out was it was hard to get a truck to haul it out. If they could have got trucks, I think we'd have lost a lot more furniture. But, you know, everyone, Town Market, New England Carpet, and those people were buying furniture a dollar down, a dollar a week. They weren't making the payments, and the company wanted it. They didn't want to use furniture so much, but they wanted to help break the strike. So we did have our problems. Now, I've kind of made a hell of a general summary, and it wasn't all internal.
Yeah, I see that. Well, one of the things you were just talking about triggered another question in my mind that doesn't have that much to do with the internal problems, but I was wondering, was there a point during this strike when things seemed more hopeless than at other times? I mean, you mentioned that towards the end of the strike, things were pretty hairy.
Oh, yes.
Was that the time when you felt the cause was perhaps lost, or did you never feel that way? Or?
I never felt that the cause was lost.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't bring myself to believe that because of the thinking that my stepdad had endured, mm-hmm. being blacklisted, and I just couldn't believe that it was ever going to happen here again. I wouldn't let myself believe it. But the question you raised, yes. As a matter of fact, some of the leaders of the Union wanted to call the strike off.
When was this?
Just a few days before it was settled.
Wow.
Not leaders of the Union, I mean members of the Union.
Uh-huh.
Not Ray Dunn or Carl or no them guys.
Uh-huh.
But there was different guys in the Union that had you know, a lot of standing. They felt that maybe we should go back and go to work.
Why?
You know, do what we can.
Now, why would they think that at that particular time?
Well, it was getting pretty hairy. Guys was in the stockade, and all this thing was coming.
Mm-hmm.
A State Federation of Labor president chopping out at you.
Mm-hmm.
Cliff Hall digging away at every time he could.
Mm-hmm.
John Gary in there doing his bit. And Olson, he's running around there for like grease on a hot griddle, one day this way and one day the next. And the Central Labor Union not wanting to support the strike for a one-day shot. We wanted it for a shot in the arm, you know.
Uh-huh.
To demonstrate to the goddamn employers that we weren't beat. We didn't get any support out of them. And the record will show they didn't. But the record would also show, if you could get those records, but we made those requests. As a matter of fact, I think Hall come out and made a statement to the contrary. And I think his statement was that we had, I can't give it to you in text, but substantially it was that we had violated the rules of the AFL. We were organizing everybody and we weren't living up to the jurisdiction lines and all this, that, and the other. It was a damaging thing.
Well, let me ask you this then. Given that the circumstances just prior to the settlement were so hairy, do you think that this cause the leaders to be willing to accept less than they would have otherwise, and
no.
that fact they want they accept?
No, no, not the primary leaders of the strike or the secondary leaders at all. Cliff Hall, the group, the few people that he had in support, they were just ready to abandon. They never mind settling, they just wanted to abandon. But the leadership, Dobbs and Bill Brown and Skogie and Ray and myself and Harry DeBoer, he was in the hospital, but all the guys that was around, we said, no, we're not going to give up, because after all, it was getting tough on the employers too, and we knew that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we, a lot of us learned a lot there, you know. I know I did, and a lot of the other guys did. And we realized that we still had a measure of power, that we weren't completely beat. And by this time, you want to remember that we had the cream of the fighters left. The hard guys, the guys that had been tested, all those Casper Melktos guys that after the shootings and the beatings and they took out and hid under the bed, they weren't no count anyway. But we had a goddamn good substantial number of guys that were pretty solid, and they remain solid. And even through the fights after the expulsion from the IBT and so forth, they didn't weaken. Them guys stayed right there. And we had some guys that crapped out on us, that thought they could get a way to go that's better. We see that all the time happening today. It's no different in Minneapolis than any place else that time. But the guys that was around at that time, there were some guys that were thinking, well, by God, maybe we better go back. Maybe Pete went back to work, and Stan's going back to work, and Herman's going back to work. Maybe we all better go back and try again some other day. Well, that wasn't for me. And it wasn't for most of the guys that was around.
Because too much had been put in.
That's right. And we knew that there was going to be no quarter. If we ever went back to work less than a settlement, we might just well never go back to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at it real objectively.
Well, I'm running out of tape.
Okay.
But I would like to talk about...
What?
I would like to talk next time about what exactly ended the
what? I can't hear you.
I'd like to talk next time we I call you about what ended the strike and the provisions of the agreement and some of those other questions from like 46 on.
From 46 on.
Yeah, let's address some of those perhaps the next time we speak.
What I remember about them fellas?
Yeah.
I had to turn my magazine here and put my glasses on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I remember them. All of them.
You do. Well, you know, it's been helpful because all throughout you've mentioned them, and I think that, you know, anyone listening to this tape or reading the transcript is going to get some idea of what kind of people they were like, but I think it might also be a good idea if you take each one.
Yeah, enumerate them.
And tell us what you remember about them.
Yeah.
So we'll do that. I also wanted to tell you that I am giving some thought to coming out to Seattle between Christmas and New Year's.
Mm-hmm.
And would like to visit with you.
Well, if I'm here, I'll certainly find time.
Oh, good. I hope that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
I will let you know for sure if I'm coming out. And I consider that at least half of the reason why I've come out.
Oh.
So... I'd really love to sit and talk with you while we're not so cramped this time.
Yeah.
So, can I call you again in about 2 weeks?
You set the date.
Okay. Well, let's make it 2 weeks from today.
I have a calendar now in front of me, so that'd be the 17th.
Yeah, that's right.
Hmm?
That's right.
9 o'clock your time and 11 here.
Well, just the opposite.
That's right, that's right. I mean, 9 o'clock here and 11 o'clock your time.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well then I'll talk to you then. And thanks again for sending the material.
Well, I'll put this other stuff in the mail.
Okay, will you send me the IWW model too?
The model?
Yeah, the one that you that you...
As from this hour?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, very good.
I don't know if it was a motto. It used to appear in their paper.
Uh-huh.
And I think we picked it up and run it in the organizer a couple of times, too.
Good.
Because there's a lot of people around, you know, that were sympathetic and former members of the IWW.
Mm-hmm.
Very well.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Maloney.
You bet.
2 weeks. Bye-bye.